Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and oprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today we're going to be talking about the Smiths versus The Cure, one of the big rivalries of 80s music. Which band is better? Why do people compare these bands? Where are The Cure stronger than The Smiths? And how are The Smiths stronger than The Cure? And are we all too sensitive to be talking about this anyway? Are we going to start crying into our pillows in our bedrooms with the walls painted black if we get too emotional about this? My guest today is Elizabeth Bracey. You may know her from the band The Paranoid Style. She's also a really good music writer, and I had her on the show because she wrote about the Smiths many years ago for Stereo Gum in a story that I really liked a lot. So I wanted to have her on the podcast to talk about the Smiths and to, I guess, be Team Smiths, like represent that side, because I am a Cure person. It's interesting. I mean, we talked about this actually a little bit last week when Pete Yorn was on the podcast. This came up. I asked him about this because I wrote a book a couple years ago. It's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. It's a book about music rivalries. And one rivalry I did not talk about in that book is The Cure and The Smiths. I think I didn't write about it because in that book, I wanted to make sure that I wrote about artists that had actual beefs at some point. So I wrote about like Tupac and Biggie, or I wrote about Blur and Oasis, or Michael Jackson and Prince. You know, people that had some sort of conflict at some point. Kanye West and Taylor Swift was another one I wrote about. And I wasn't aware at that time that The Cure and The Smiths actually had sort of direct confrontation. I always thought it was one of those things that fans of the band would talk about. You know, in the same way that, like, if you grew up in the 80s and 90s, you would talk about, you know, U2 and REM. You know, those bands were friends, basically. But, you know, if you were a fan of one, there was a good chance you were a fan of the other. And fans of those bands like to debate each other about what band was better. And I thought that was true of The Smiths and The Cure. But, of course, I was wrong, because there's a long history of Morrissey and Robert Smith saying terrible things about each other. And I really regret not writing about it. I mean, that would have been a really fun chapter to talk about. I mean, I think ultimately when we talk about these two bands, it's really a discussion about whether you value longevity in a band or if you value a band that sort of burns out quickly and brightly. You know, a band that hits really high peaks for a short amount of time and then they flame out. And there's definitely people who prefer that kind of band. And then there's other people who like it when a band can be good for a sustained period of time, for a decade or more. And I think The Cure fall into that camp. I think certainly from the late 70s into the early 90s, they were a consistently good and often great band. Whereas The Smiths, you know, they were basically here and gone within about 5 years. So I got into it with Elizabeth. We talked about these bands. We kind of compared and contrast, and we tried to get to the bottom of, you know, why do people prefer The Smiths over The Cure, and why do people prefer The Cure over The Smiths? And I think it was a really fun conversation, and I'm excited to get to it. But before we do, I want to talk about our sponsor for this week, Blind Tiger Record Club. Now, what is Blind Tiger Record Club? It is a vinyl record subscription box service delivered to your door each month. You pick from all kinds of different styles, like alternative, singer, songwriter, rock, jazz, soul, blues, whatever you like, and they mail your record selection out at the end of each month. All the vinyl is new, all the 12-inch records are new, some are double albums, they're heavyweight, and some of them are even hard to find import records. The best part of it is the service. Their selections are announced prior to shipping, giving customers the option to choose which album they want each month. Now, subscriptions to the Blind Tiger Record Club start at $25.99. But for listeners of this podcast, we have a special deal. You use the code CELEBRATION at the checkout to receive 50% off your first subscription box. The minimum subscription is 3 months, so the first box is half off, then the following two will be the full price at $25.99. So again, subscribers get member pricing and free shipping on items added to their monthly box. Again, that's the Blind Tiger Record Club, your vinyl, your choice. Okay, so here is me and Elizabeth We got into it. We're talking about the Smiths versus the Cure. And it was a really fun conversation. And I think I won this debate, but we'll let you guys decide. We'll let you decide if the Cure is the better band or if the Smiths still reign victorious. Here's the conversation between me and Elizabeth about the Smiths and the Cure. I'm not sure exactly what your history is with the Smiths when you started listening to them and becoming a fan. Like, were you like a music fan like in the 80s, like when those records were coming out?
It would be disingenuous to say that. I mean, because I was like a child in the 80s. So I wasn't that precocious or that exploratory in the 80s. I think I actually came to the Smiths first in the 90s when I was, you know, like an adolescent and a teenager. I think probably like 91 or 92 is when I first heard the Smiths. So this would have been after they had already broken up.
Okay, so your trajectory is very similar to mine then, because that's about when I started listening to them. I was alive as well in the 80s, but I was in grade school, and you know, I was listening to Paula Abdul and Janet Jackson and Millie Vanilli
and
awesome stuff like that.
About the same age.
Right. So you get into them sort of, you know, in the alternative era, like in the 90s. At that time, like, were you aware that there was this rivalry with the Cure at the time, that those bands were compared? Did that enter your thinking at all with these bands?
Superficially. I didn't actually know that there was, you know, a deep rivalry within them. I know that there was probably competition between their fan bases, and I feel like this was something that just happened, you know, between, like, my friends and I. Like, you would pick one or the other. But no, I didn't know anything about the actual rivalry that existed between the two bands.
See, because that, I have the same thing. Like, I don't think I really appreciated that. And then, you know, a couple years ago, I wrote that book, Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, about pop rivalries, and people kept asking me why I didn't write about The Cure and The Smiths. Like, it was the mm-hmm. it was the one rivalry that came up the most. And when I wrote that book, my thinking was that I didn't want to write about rivalries that largely or exclusively existed in the minds of fans. You know, like how fans used to compare U2 and REM. You know, like how, you know, because they were two kind of similar bands, and a lot of the same people liked both bands, but those bands didn't really ever have a beef. So I didn't write about mm-hmm. that. And I wasn't aware of The Cure and The Smiths having a beef, and now I really regret not knowing this, because it would have been a lot of fun to write about. And, you know, just getting ready to talk to you today for the podcast, I was going online and looking at, you know, various stories about the history of Robert Smith and Morrissey talking smack about each other. And, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but, you know, there was an interview, Morrissey, 1984, where the interviewer asked him, if I put you in a room with Robert Smith, Mark E. Smith, and a loaded Smith & Wesson, who would bite the bullet first? And Morrissey said, I'd line them up so that one bullet penetrated both of them simultaneously. Robert Smith is a wingbag, which I don't know what a wingbag is. I assume that's not a very good thing. And there's just like a history of like terrible quotes. And it's mainly coming from Robert Smith reacting to, I think, the early sort of smack talking that Morrissey was doing. There's the really famous quote, I don't know if you've ever heard this one, where he said, if Morrissey told me not to eat meat, I would eat meat. That's how much I hate Morrissey. Like, that's probably the best quote from...
Wow.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I had never heard that.
Yeah, and I think the thing was, you know, I think it was instigated by Morrissey saying bad things about The Cure, and then Robert Smith, that really sticking in his craw over the years, and then people probably just asking him about it, you know, for years afterward, and he would always take the bait and say bad things about Morrissey. You talked about how you and your friends would often talk about those two bands, and some people maybe like The Cure and other people like The Smiths. Like, were you anti-Cure, or did you like both bands?
I liked both bands. I think The Cure is great. They, at the time, I guess, you know, when you have a limited income, you can really only pick up certain records. And so I think I just went Team Smiths because their concerns were more my concerns than The Cure. But I don't want to, you know, discount Robert Smith, and I certainly don't want to upset him, because he sounds very withering. But, Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, if it, in just sort of in like casual conversation with my friends, like, you know, the argument that I would always make is that, like, for The Cure, and they were just records that I wasn't as familiar with, but, you know, if you think about a record like Disintegration, it's just kind of this, like, emotional nuclear holocaust where all of his preoccupations are either like ecstatic love or despairing love. And that's great. But you take a guy like Morrissey and the Smiths, and their preoccupations are so much more panoramic and so much more interesting. And he's doing this world building and creating these wonderful sympathetic characters that I just loved. And so it didn't resonate as deeply with me. So, you know, I wouldn't say it ever really got very heated in terms of, you know, like schoolyard debates with my buddies. But I think that's where it would kind of start with me for my passion for the Smiths and my sort of just like lukewarm liking of The Cure.
And like, what was the gateway for you with the Smiths? Like, was there a particular record that got you into them?
Sure. It was a practical matter. I picked up Louder Than Bombs first because it had the most songs on it. So I felt like I was getting the most bang for my buck. And yeah, I mean, that was a big time gateway drug. I mean, so I'm just like this shy kid, you know, growing up on Long Island. And, you know, I can't tell you how much those tracks meant to me. Just as a young person, because he, you know, these songs like Sheila Takes a Bow or Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now just animated these characters that seemed a lot like me. And I hadn't experienced that before in rock music. You know, I hadn't yet heard like Stephanie Says or I'll Be Your Mirror. And Stuart Murdoch was a few years off for me. So I just couldn't believe that anyone cared as much. And it just seemed obvious to me that he did. And I think that remains the essence of his best work, is just the humanity and empathy that he would bring to these kind of misfit characters. I mean, he really was like the voice of outcasts and wallflowers. And that was meaningful to me at the time.
And you also mentioned something earlier, too, that I think is important, that the Smiths, I think, for the people who really love them, they often talk about, you know, there's the misery in those songs, but there's also a lot of wit in those songs. Mm-hmm. Like Morrissey's a pretty funny guy. And it sounds like for you that maybe the Smiths were more dynamic in that way than maybe The Cure was.
Totally. Yeah, he's hilarious. I mean, the one-liners just abound. And I mean, he's clever, but yeah, he's super duper funny. And I think that was really important to me as well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because my thinking on this has evolved over time, because for the longest time, if I were going to compare these two bands, I would always give the edge to the Smiths for a lot of the reasons that you just said. I think also because the Smiths just have higher peaks than The Cure does. You know, the mm-hmm. best Smith songs, I think, are probably better than the best Cure songs. But over time, and I mean, you could talk about the issues with Morrissey, you know, and we'll get to that in a minute. You know, we'll put that off to the side for now.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I've really come to appreciate the longevity of The Cure, you know, because I think ultimately that's what this discussion is about. Like for people who are inclined to compare these bands, that it's a discussion about the bands, but it's also a discussion about like what you value more. Do you value a band that is good for a long time, or do you value like real greatness, like something like that hits a really high peak, and maybe it's not around for a long time, but the peak, like at the time that it was good, it was really great. And mm-hmm. it seems to me that that's what it boils down to with these two bands. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think another way to phrase it might be, is it better to burn out than fade away?
Did you just make that up?
Do you think that has the ring of a hit in it?
Yeah, maybe. That's catchy. I like that.
But yeah, I mean, you know, The Cure is a slow burn. The Smiths are a supernova. The Smiths were a band for what, like 5 years? I mean, they were broken up before their last record came out. And The Cure they started earlier than the Smiths, and they are, you know, still active. And so, you know, I think that was kind of the genius of the Smiths, though, was that they are really prolific in those 5 years. And I find that, like, you know, the majority of the songs that they had that they managed to write, and they wrote a lot of them in a very short amount of time, they're pretty undeniable hits. I mean, yeah, The Cure has been together a lot longer, so I think if we were to try to match them up quantitatively, The Cure would take the advantage for this category. But, you know, if we were to, like, try and, you know, do some adjusted scoring, they might kind of even up a little bit more, in fairness to the Smiths, since I am supposed to defend them, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I feel like the band that does burn out, they do seem to fare better in history in a lot of ways. Like, I think about Nirvana versus Pearl Jam, for instance, like with young people, you know, people who weren't alive when those bands were really big. Like, Nirvana seems to be the cooler band to wear the t-shirt or to listen to the records, whereas Pearl Jam's just been this band that's been around forever. And maybe when you think about Pearl Jam, you think about Pearl Jam now and not what they were at their peak. And that influences how subsequent generations think about them. Or I think about, like, REM and The Replacements, you know, where, like, The Replacements are, like, cool in a way that REM isn't, even though I think REM probably had a better career. You know, they also had 15 years where they were associated with, like, adult contemporary radio, you know. And I find that when I talk to younger people who discovered those records, like, well after the fact, that's how they associate REM. They think of them as sort of like a band that you'd hear next to Billy Joel or something, and, you know, not with the Smiths or the Replacements or any of those 80s bands. And it seems like something similar has happened with the Smiths and the Cure. Like, you talked about the Smiths, like, for you, you got into them after they had already broken up, and that was true for me too. And there was a mythology about the Smiths already in the early 90s that The Cure didn't have, because, I mean, The Cure was still having hits at that time. You know, like Friday, I'm in Love, and songs like that, like, were on MTV all the time, and they were sort of like the band that wore makeup and, you know, stuff like that. And, or like the goth band, you know, like, and I don't know if you had this at your school. Like, at my school, there were always, like, the group of kids that wore Cure t-shirts and, like, had, like, Robert Smith hair, and that was, like, a definite click at the school, and that sort of translated to the band in a way. It was like, oh, you're, like, one of those Cure kids if you listen to The Cure, you know. So there's a stigma there almost for liking them. It wasn't a cool thing necessarily to be a fan of The Cure at that time. I mean, was that true at your school? Did you have Cure kids at your school,
or was that totally just like yeah we had Cure kids and Smith's kids they weren't necessarily ostracized or considered losers or anything, but there was that sort of, it was all in, like, this nascent alt movement that, you know, I think I definitely saw kids with Robert Smith haircuts, and I wasn't sure what was going on with them internally, but they looked cool to me.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why I didn't necessarily associate them with Outkast. But for all I know, maybe the football team was beating them up every day.
Right. I mean, yeah, they were cool to me. Although those same kids, they kind of morphed into, like, the Nine Inch Nails kids, like, a couple of years later. And, you know, they were not the cool kids in school, but they were cool, like, to me as, like, another kind of outcast feeling person. But I think I looked up to them in a way because they owned being an outcast more than I did. Like, I was like the kid that would try to fit in, and they were like, no, we are decidedly not going to fit in. We are going to wear the Robert Smith hair in the middle of Wisconsin in the early 90s, and we're going to own people's stares and all that stuff, which I thought was cool, but I would never have the courage to do something like that at that age. You know, my case for The Cure, especially now, like, revisiting those records, is that I think that they did more over the course of their career, not just because it was longer, but I'm really kind of blown away by how influential The Cure ended up being. I don't think that people at the time, would have appreciated that or have anticipated that, but there's so much music that has happened in the last 10 years that I feel like is influenced by The Cure. Sometimes it's not even acknowledged that it's influenced by The Cure, but, you know, just so much, I guess, like the sort of goth, shoegaze, chill wavy wing of indie rock. You know, like there was a recent list on Pitchfork about like the best dream pop records of all time. And like The Cure wasn't on that list. But I feel like a lot of those dream pop records derive from like what The Cure was doing in the late 80s, like on Disintegration. And I don't know. To me, that I think that's just unexpected because, like, it, you know, at the time, The Cure was not critically acclaimed in the same way that the Smiths were. I mean, The Cure kind of wasn't taken as seriously, I think, as Morrissey was as a lyricist. I think they were looked at as sort of being this kind of gloomy teenager music that would sort of burn itself out. And yet it's proved to be, I think, really enduring, I mean, almost at least as enduring, I think, as the Smiths have.
I think that's a very, very fair point. I hadn't thought of that, and I would definitely concede the point to The Cure for that. Without the Smiths, you don't get Belle and Sebastian.
Right.
I'm trying to think who else. I mean, I think that the sonics that Johnny Marr provided to the Smiths and the arrangements that he gave probably did influence some of the, you know, Manchester sound that was emerging at the time. And now I'm trying to think of like a contemporary band that maybe takes a direct line from the Smiths, and I'm having a hard time coming up with one, save for Belle and Sebastian, who I, you know, Stuart Murdoch is not coy about his adoration of Morrissey.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Smiths, the case you would make, I mean, I feel like a lot of the Britpop bands are, you know, I think they were probably inspired by the Smiths. I mean, I think the Smiths' big thing was that they made guitar-based indie music cool in Britain again in the mid-80s, you know, which was a time that was very sort of synthesizer-dominant. You know, there weren't a lot of cool guitar bands, and, like, the Smiths brought that back. And I know that, like, you know, like Noel Gallagher has talked about being a huge Smiths fan, and, like, I feel like a lot of those 90s Britpop people were probably similarly inspired by the Smiths, like when they were teenagers, and that, you know, maybe they wouldn't have formed rock bands without the Smiths, or like maybe you wouldn't have like the Stone Roses, you know, like without the Smiths. I mean, the Smiths are clearly, I think, you know, one of those sort of archetypal indie rock bands, in that, you know, how many, I mean, it's hard to list specific examples because there's so many bands that have the sensitive, poetic lead singer and like the cool guitar player and, you know, and like the good rhythm section, you know, the nondescript rhythm section, but like, you know, that dynamic I think is so common. There's like a million bands that have that, and you know, the Smiths, we're definitely pioneers in that way. Hey guys, we'll get back to our conversation in a minute. I just want to tell you about something I'm really excited about, which is the release of my new book, Twilight of the Gods: A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. It comes out May 8th, and it's available for pre-order right now from wherever you like to buy books. Twilight of the Gods is about rock stars and how they all seem to be retiring or even dying right now. If you're like me, you grew up listening to Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, The Beatles, and The Stones, even though it's been years, even decades, since those groups were in their primes or even still together. How has this music endured for so long, and what is the attraction of classic rock culture, and what impact did it have on the world? And what will happen to the music now that so many stars are exiting the stage permanently? My book covers all these things, as well as, well, a lot of other cool stuff about artists like Neil Young, Bob Seger, Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney, Black Sabbath, AC/DC. There's a little bit about REO Speedwagon in there. There's a Fish chapter in there. There's Pearl Jam. There's Wilco. Man, there's like a million bands covered in this book. So if you like this podcast, you're going to like the book. Just go to wherever you buy books and punch in Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. It comes out May 8th. Pre-order it now. Okay, enough shilling. Let's get back to our conversation. One reason why this topic is relevant, you know, talking about the Cure and the Smiths, is, well, the Cure, you know, they're doing this 40th anniversary concert at Hyde Park this summer. So people have been talking about the Cure, and there's like a really good lineup at that festival that they're curating. And then with the Smiths, you have another round of Morrissey interviews where he's saying terrible things. And you have people going on social media, throwing their hands up in the air, saying, okay, I'm finally done with Morrissey now. You know, I'm throwing away my Smiths records because of what he said. What's your take on that? I mean, this is something that we're dealing with, not just with Morrissey, but with all kinds of artists. You know, their actions or their comments affecting how we perceive the art. How has that affected your perception of Morrissey and the Smiths?
Right. I mean, you know, Morrissey is difficult and he's challenging and he's not looked great lately. It's funny, you know, the day that you asked me to talk about the Smiths, like right after I emailed you, I saw like two headlines on Twitter about things that he had said recently about halal meat and Hitler. And I was just like, oh man, you know, he says a lot of things. You know, if I am to defend Morrissey, and I don't know him personally, I think, first of all, you know, he has been teeing this up from the start. On the first record, you know, on the A side of the Smiths album, he says, I'm not the man you think I am. And I think that he has been trying to subvert expectations of him since the beginning. I think that he is at war with the media constantly. And I think he likes to wind them up. I think that he fashions himself as being this kind of very literary guy who is following in a British tradition of taking on sort of right-wing perspectives because he wants to hold up a mirror to left-wing hypocrisies. And I think that, you know, we want him to be this avatar of left-wing ideology because he was an anti-Thatcherite and he's able to critique the monarchy and he's a vegan. But he's also a guy who is, you know, neurotic and insecure, and he comes from Manchester, and he's very concerned about London elites, and so maybe a populist movement like Brexit really hits him where he lives. So, you know, he's definitely thorny, and he definitely says things that I disagree with, and I, you know, it's tough to defend him without knowing him because I don't think that anybody really knows Morrissey, and I think he wants it that way. But he's just so complicated because he thinks he's so smart and so special. And I think that he wants to kind of be, you know, the sort of voice and eyes of Britain from every perspective. And so, I mean, God knows why he's doing this. You know, to throw out your, if you want to throw out your Smiths records, I get it. It's okay. You know, it concerns me a little bit, you know, that you can just, you know, dispense with great art. And I don't know if Morrissey's doing a character, if he's actually just calcified into just a right-wing crazy guy. I don't know, you know, why it is. If he's just a jerk, but he writes great songs, is it impossible to take any enjoyment out of it? I mean, at what point does it, you know, sort of become a kind of fascism of its own?
Right.
If we are just going to say, well, if you don't, you know, toe the left-wing line, then, you know, your art should be burned on a fire. I just think that, you know, we're stepping towards some very dangerous territory, and I don't think we're there yet, but I mean, you know, Morrissey's super duper weird, and, you know, he's been canceling shows for health problems, and we don't know what those are about. So, you know, maybe, you know, he's just an old man, and he's got some crazy ideas, and I don't know anybody who's gotten more flexible as they've gotten older right. In their ideas.
I mean, I think I agree with what you said. There is something about him that has not changed, I don't think. I mean, maybe certain ideas that he's had have changed now that he's an old guy, and maybe he's like a crazy white-wing guy, but there is also something in him that's always been there, which is he's this provocative person, and he likes to push mm-hmm. buttons, and he's a contrarian. And that he would say things that are offensive to people, it does not seem like out it doesn't seem beyond the pale for him. You know, it doesn't seem outside of his character. It's not shocking that he would say these things. Again, in sort of like a reactionary way. Like, I think that, like, when he's talking about, you know, elements of the left being like super judgmental and all that stuff, I feel like that's him probably looking at the internet and seeing certain things and getting upset about it and reacting to it. You know, I don't know if it's more thoughtful than that. You know, because I feel like he probably has that in him to a degree. Like, if he knows that people may be moving in lockstep in a certain direction, that he's going to intentionally go the opposite way. And, you know, I feel like there's an element of that in, say, like Kanye West as well. Like, when people get mad at Kanye West, and, you know, I was like anyone else when I saw him wear the Make America Great Again hat, I groaned. You know, that just seemed awful. But at the same time, this is a guy who put a song called I Am a God on his record. You know, there's a history of like megalomania in his persona and on his records. You know, he's often been petulant, and he's often, you know, shot from the hip and been unhinged. And, you know, people love that about him until he says something that crosses the line or feels like it goes against their own personal beliefs. I don't know. I mean, to me, there's an element of pop music that is like pro wrestling, you know, and that pop stars are like wrestlers, and some wrestlers are heroes and some are heels. And Morrissey is a heel, just like Kanye is a heel. And the heelish aspects of their personas are, it's kind of what you love about them. Like Morrissey being kind of this, you know, very acidic person, there's great lyrics that he's written that are in that style. And then he does these terrible interviews that are also, you know, just makes you want to throw your computer out the window. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say that like this violates the spirit of what his songs were about, because I feel like that's kind of always been in his songs. So if you love the songs, maybe just listen to the songs and take those seriously and ignore the stupid things that they say in interviews. You know, like, I mean, I don't know. I think on some level, interviews are like performance art for people like that. And we shouldn't look so much at the specific content of what they're saying as much as like the gestures of just provocation that take place in those places. And does that make sense to you? I don't know. Like, maybe we are over rationalizing this terrible behavior. My producer Derek is shaking his head furiously. Yes, that we are.
But this is the most generous reading of Morrissey's behavior in action that I think you could I could possibly
Well,
imagine.
You know, he's I'll stand by it, because look, I'm not looking to Morrissey for like political commentary or anything like that. He's to me like I think he's an insightful writer, and sometimes he's a buffoon, and like I kind of like both aspects of him.
And he's a bad person. He's a bad human being.
You don't know that, Derek.
Who is therefore alienated from other human beings and then writes songs about that in an insightful way.
Oh, man. See, Derek has been biting his lip this entire time.
Yeah, sorry. I haven't been holding back. I really, really, you know, in the industry, it's sort of known that Morrissey's just a guy you don't want to deal with. He's literally the worst business partner.
Right.
And so, you know, there's just all these stories of him treating people terribly. You know, you mentioned the canceled shows for health reasons. Health reasons is always the thing he cites when he just doesn't want to show up somewhere. So,
right.
I don't know. It's all to me like part and parcel of the whole experience, like him just being a bad guy.
All right. I'm going to let you rant about that more later.
Okay, bye.
I want to get back to Elizabeth here, though. So, like, let's get back to the records here. You know, I think we both like both bands. I think you lean towards the Smiths. I'm leaning more towards the Cure, I think, these days. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the records, though. Like, for people who are listening who maybe are new to both bands, or maybe they're indifferent, you know, you mentioned Louder Than Bombs was your gateway. And I know that when you wrote about the Smiths on Stereo Gum, that was, I think, the number one record on your list. You know, in terms of the records, like, is there a particular record or song that you would play for someone to get them into the band or to explain, like, why this band was great?
Sure. I mean, absent of Louder Than Bombs, which I think would be the one that I would tell people to get if you're only going to get one, just because they're such a great singles band that that's got, it's just loaded with hits. If you want to actually kind of experience like the gestalt of the Smiths, if I may, I would say Get the Queen is Dead. I think that has the whole sort of socio-political sweep of Morrissey's interest. It's got a couple of his great emotional tracks. You know, I Know It's Over, and There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. And it's funny and it's humane, and you know, it's they're kind of firing on all cylinders on that record. So I think that one's a real masterpiece. That would be the one I would also encourage people to listen to if you really want to get the sense of, like, you know, what are these guys all about.
See, like, when you made your cereal gum list, I'm glad that you put Louder Than Bombs first and Queen is Dead second, because I feel like the conventional wisdom is that the Queen is Dead is like the ultimate Smiths record, and everything you just said I think is right. I think as an album it definitely is like their sort of high water mark, but mm-hmm. for me, like, the Smiths has always been first and foremost a singles band, and like there's like a million different singles compilations for the Smiths, but like yeah. like the singles put together to me is like they're sort of like that's like their tombstone or like their legacy, because you know, I think they put out, I think they made good albums, but the singles are so great, and I feel like the combination of like Morrissey's lyrics and Johnny Marr's guitar, like those great guitar hooks, they just it's perfectly suited for like the 4-minute single, you know, and they really were yeah. masters of that. And I think, you know, if you're going to compare maybe again, the Smiths and the Cure, like the Cure to me, I think they're more of an album band actually than the Smiths are. I think the Cure actually has a great, they have many great singles compilations as well. The famous one is Standing on a Beach. That's like the one that I remember always seeing like older sisters of my friends owning, like, like everyone, like the album, like with the old man on the cover with the black and white photo. But like, cause like for me, like talking about the Cure, like if I was going to introduce someone to that band, I would play them Disintegration. And you mentioned yeah. that record before. I think you said it was like an emotional apocalypse or something like that, which I think yeah. is a very apt descriptor of that record. And you're right in that, you know, I think the Smiths are more nuanced. I think they're more writerly in the songs. Like Morrissey does feel like more like a proper writer. When you listen to his lyrics, like you feel like you could read his lyrics and enjoy them as much. Although hearing him sing them definitely takes it to another level, or croon them, or sing whine them, however you want to put it. Whereas the Cure is, you know, a more sort of straightforward, earnest, I guess maybe again teenage type band. But if you're on their wavelength, there's a real power and beauty to what they're doing, and on Disintegration, they really become the masters of like the 2-minute instrumental intro, you know, which was a trick that like a lot of bands in the early 2000s stole from them, you know, Interpol being an example of that. But there's a bunch of other bands too that were really influenced by the Cure. And it's funny because I feel like with Interpol, they were always accused of ripping off Joy Division, but they actually sound mm-hmm. a lot more like the Cure. But like, I think critics compared them to Joy Division because that's a cooler reference point than the Cure is. You know, it's like not as, you know, the Cure is, I think even at that time was maybe sort of out of fashion, so people didn't want to give them credit for that. But Disintegration just has so many sort of slowly unfolding songs. Pictures of You being a great example. Plain mm-hmm. Song, of course, Love Song is on that record. That was a big hit single for them. But you know, these sort of like very sort of deliberately paced, languorous songs that slowly unfold, pretty bombastic, you know, because they were playing arenas at that time, so the music really swelled to fill those places. It's one of those albums that you just put on with headphones and it kind of sets a mood and it fills your ears with like almost like an orchestra of guitars and synthesizers. And I think the epicness of The Cure at that time, yeah. what they had evolved into was really appealing to me. I mean, you know, the Cure, they have a long enough sort of glory period where there are different eras of their career. And like certainly in the early part of their career, they were more of a post-punk band. and they sort of gradually became this arena rock band by the end of the 80s. And I'm sure there's people that fell off with them at that time, but that's sort of the sweet spot for me, from Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me to Disintegration and then on to Wish in the early 90s. All those are great records. So I would recommend any of those, but certainly Disintegration would be at the top of my list. And you can listen to Disintegration and Louder Than Bombs, trade off tracks, have a little battle of the bands of the 80s at your place. Both of them are great bands, but I'm glad that you agree with me that The Cure is better. So no. I'm glad that I convinced you in this podcast that you're on my side now, right? Or are you still Smiths?
I'm still Team Smiths. I mean, The Cure is great, but they're general. The Smiths are so specific and idiosyncratic. I mean, if you want to have a solid, you know, just epic listening time to a band that talks about, like, a couple things, then go with The Cure. You know, if you really want to explore the universe of possibilities, then, and you know, you know, the Cure is going from the emotional gambit from A to B. The Smiths, they're the entire alphabet.
Right.
So, you know, it depends on what you like.
But, you know, A and B, those are two great letters. So if you're going to stick with two letters, it might as well just be A and B. Elizabeth, it was so much fun talking with you about this. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Stephen. This was a real joy. And as I say, the pleasure and privilege is mine.
All right. Take care. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so that's me and Elizabeth talking about the Smiths versus The Cure. Always fun to talk about these two bands. And I feel like I got to give Derek the floor here. He was like chewing his lip so hard there was blood gushing from his face, I think. He's biting his tongue.
Yeah, I'm sorry to jump in at all, but I was
expecting you to, because I know you hate Morrissey so much.
I have very strong feelings about this, and the thing is I really like Johnny Marr, and I do see some value to the music of the Smiths, but I just find Morrissey to be so odious a character, and I don't know, the notion that we're going to give extra credit for this man's ultimately obnoxious vocal stylings. the lyrics, I'll grant you, like, you know, it's a great case for the whole emotional alphabet. I get it. The man knows how to write a sad song, and he knows how to paint a few other emotions too, some really subtle ones that you don't have. But the singing is so annoying, and he's so annoying, and to me, it's inescapable and inseparable. Just the ridiculous things that the man paws off and says in real life, like, they're all part and parcel of the whole experience. I think they all come through
the records. It starts with you with hating his music, though, right?
Yeah.
Like if you loved his music, the comments would complicate it and maybe it would turn you off. But it would be more of a struggle for you. Like, him being a jerk in real life, it confirms your suspicion that he's like full of shit in his music.
Correct.
As well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the whole package is just full of shit. And you know, the other thing I would dispute, you know, the notion of, I mean, look, obviously one band was around a lot longer. So, you know, there is a sort of burn bright versus, you know, lasting longevity. But I think if you line up the best Cure singles against the best Smith singles, I'll have that argument with you every day. I'll take Just Like Heaven and Close to Me and Pictures of You and Love Song and Friday I'm in Love. And, I mean, there's a murderer's row of Cure singles. In Between Days,
right,
that might be the best one, you know. And the Smiths, it's like, all right, so you got Panic and There's a Light That Never Goes Out, How Soon Is Now, Ask Me, This Charming Man. I'll take that Cure group. And I would also add that I think the Cure threw in better albums. Now, they've made a lot of albums and they have some bad ones, and the Smiths weren't around to make bad records, but
right,
give me the highs of the Cure, man.
I mean, you know, look, I'm team Cure, so like, I'm amenable to that argument. I guess I feel like in terms of just as a song, as a standalone statement, like, How Soon Is Now, There's a Light That Never Goes Out, The Boy with the Thorn in His Side, they're so strong. I feel like, again, I prefer the Smiths in single mode. And with The Cure, as much as I love all those songs, and I think they're all amazing singles, it's like, with Just Like Heaven, it's like, oh, I like hearing that on the record, too. Like, to me, that's also part of an album as much as it is a single. So, like, I think with the Smiths, for me, it's so much about the singles that, like, they just seem perfect in a way that maybe those Cure songs aren't as great as they are.
Yeah, I mean, the Smiths are, I guess, an ideal compilation band, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, there has been this thing that's taken over now, like, where, like, The Queen Is Dead always shows up on, like, top 10 lists. And,
yeah.
You know, there was a, what was that? There was some magazine, some British magazine. It might have been The Enemy. No, who was that? That was... anyway, some British magazine, like, they ranked the 50 greatest artists of all time, and they put the Smiths at number one, like, above the Beatles, you know? And, like, they said, like, The Queen Is Dead is, like, the greatest British rock album of all time. And I feel like The Queen Is Dead has that sort of mythology about it now.
It does sound like an NME thing to do.
And I don't think the record quite justifies it. Like, I think it's a great record, but I don't think it's, like, the greatest record. And I would rather listen to a singles compilation by the Smiths than The Queen Is Dead. Whereas I think, as much as I love Cure singles, I think I would pick Disintegration over a greatest hits record. I think that as a record, it's such a great experience. It's such a great mood, atmospheric type record. It really stands alone, I think, as an album.
Yeah. Although
statement.
You did mention this earlier, like the Cure's, you know, Standing on the Beach it's pretty good, man.
That's great. That's great. And like The Cure also had this thing of, I mean, Elizabeth made a point, I think, about the lyrics of both bands, The Cure maybe being a little more sort of one note, or, you know, it's kind of dealing with Robert Smith being miserable. I mean, that's kind of like the thing of Cure songs. But I think musically they were more diverse than the Smiths. I mean, both bands kind of had a distinct sound that they stuck to throughout their careers. But like, if you listen to early Cure music, it doesn't sound like Three Imaginary Boys. Doesn't sound like Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. I mean, they were more of like a punk band at the beginning,
right?
And then they evolved into this. I mean, they're one of the architects of like alt rock, like that sound. Like, you know, if you like Smashing Pumpkins, I feel like they stole a lot from The Cure. Like those late 80s Cure albums, I think, are like totally setting the stage for a lot of like the big sounding alt rock of the 90s.
Yeah. And I think their aesthetic was also hugely influential. You know what I mean? The style aesthetic, there's so many bands that I think, you know, take fashion cues from The Cure. And like you said, so many, it's still like, you'll still see those gothy looking Cure kids, like in the South Park kind of jokes.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Like that's still a thing that exists now.
It's funny though. Cause I mean, you know, I talked about this a little bit, the Cure's like critical reputation. I mean, I feel like it's still being rehabilitated that it, I mean, they're not as well regarded as the Smiths. And I know like when I've brought this topic up with people, there are Smiths fans who look at you like you're crazy to even suggest that The Cure might be on the same level as the Smiths, much less better than the Smiths. Like there's this idea that the Smiths are like this perfect band and that The Cure is this sort of like long-running alt-rock band that had some glory periods here and there, but you know, they're just sort of a band you go see at Riot Fest and enjoy, you know, like with right. The Pixies now, you know, and other, you know, these sort of nostalgic era bands at festivals like that. You know, and they're not, and I mean, neither band is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I mean, I would expect the Smiths probably to get in before The Cure, even though The Cure has had, I think, probably more of a popular impact than the Smiths have. And coupled with, I think, a discography that is comparable, if not better, you know, I don't know. They seem like a little underrated still.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you say, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about, you know, Smiths fans reacting in that way, but wouldn't you say that that's a monument to their own obsessiveness about this band? Like, do you think that people who have no skin in this game, and I admit I certainly do, that I have negative skin in this game, really. But like people who don't, who aren't invested in it, don't really think of the Smiths as much more than like the How Soon Is Now guys.
I don't know. I mean, I think to know the Smiths is probably to have a passionate opinion about them. I mean, they're not like The Cure in that The Cure have like genuinely big hit songs. like they have songs that everybody has heard of. Like Friday I'm in Love is like a pretty like deathless radio hit song. Whereas the Cure, whereas the Smiths, they have songs that get played on the radio now. But I don't know. I think there's a lot of people that who have heard of the Cure and may not know who the Smiths are. You know, I think there's probably more people like that than we might think. Yeah. I mean, I think generally, if you like one, you probably like the other. I mean, it's hard, because I think that they're both in the same sort of lane of like 80s music. Kind of like what Elizabeth said. We were taking opposite sides in that. I mean, we didn't even really debate. I mean, we both like both bands. I mean, you hate the Smiths.
Yes.
And you like The Cure. So, but I think
the exception here, I think.
But I think generally people like them both. But, you know, it's interesting. Like I said, when I wrote that book, that was the rivalry people asked me about the most. And I think it was something that people argued a lot about. If you liked both bands, you know, which one was better? And I think that they both had their own attributes. They were similar enough, but they were different enough that comparing them was fun.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's almost like, you know, an Oasis Blur thing if you totally took all the class stuff out of it. You know what I mean? Because it's like sort of two people from the same class. It's much more about the personality types of the people involved.
Right. Totally. And, you know, again, it's weird to think of The Cure as like the people's band, but I think in this respect they were, you know? I think that there is maybe something a little bit more populist maybe about The Cure than the Smiths. Because I think, again, the popular perception is that The Cure was this sort of teenage band and the Smiths were more of a serious, you know, sort of like a band for a more discerning music listener.
Yeah. You know? I think she made a great point in how specific sort of the Smith's phenomenon is. You know
right.
what I mean?
Totally. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we did settle it now between you and me that The Cure is better.
Yep. And we're done.
So we're done. Okay. Well, that is it for our episode this week. Special shout out, as always, to Derek Madden for putting it together and for hating Morrissey.
And my pleasure.
And shout out to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. Thank you, Josh. And thank you all for listening and for supporting the podcast. We would not be here without you. So thank you very much for that. We will talk to you again next week.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.